Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of our show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about highway safety, and we will be concentrating particularly on trucks and safety issues involving long-distance trucking. Over the past 3 years, the federal agency that is responsible for truck safety has relaxed rules on driver training, on record-keeping, and also, perhaps most important, the number of hours that drivers spend behind the wheel. Auto safety groups say that these changes have made accidents more likely. On the other hand, the government says that the truck fatality rate has actually declined over the last few years. This morning, we'll be talking about this debate over trucks and highway safety. And our guest for the program is Gerald Donaldson. He is Senior Research Director of an organization called Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety. It's a highway and motor vehicle safety public interest lobbying organization, has been there since 1991. Before that, he was, for a number of years, co-chair of Citizens for Reliable and Safe Highways, known by its initials as CRASH, a nationwide truck safety public interest organization. And before that, he was a researcher and advocate for the Center for Auto Safety. That's a nonprofit public interest consumer organization. He is joining us this morning by telephone. As questions come in here, they're certainly welcome. If you'd like to call in, ask a question, make a comment, be a part of the conversation, you certainly may do that. All you need to do is pick up the telephone and dial the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So here again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Dr. Donaldson, hello.
Good morning, Mr. Inge. How are you,
sir? I'm good, thanks. And thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate
it. My pleasure.
Just maybe you might want to talk for a moment about your organization, Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety. What's what it's all about?
Yes, Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety was founded in 1989. We deal with the entire gamut of issues involving highway and motor vehicle safety. That includes highway design and traffic engineering, human factors involving the driver and passengers, and motor vehicle design, both heavy vehicles and light vehicles, and how we can make them both more crash-worthy and improve their crash avoidance capability so that we can lower the annual death toll.
Okay. And we do here, I know here at the beginning we're going to concentrate on this issue of truck safety, but perhaps once we've discussed that, maybe people might have some other kinds of questions related to highway safety, and I guess we'd say if they want to ask them, that's okay. We won't turn people away if they want to ask about something that doesn't have anything to do with trucks. But it really, our main reason for wanting to do this and place to start out was indeed to talk about deregulation in the industry over the last couple of years and whether or not that has safety implications. I guess the answer that you and your organization would give to that question is yes. It has not been a good thing. Does it mean that our highways are less safe?
Yes, they're definitely less safe for the American public who's traveling the roads and sharing the roads for the trucks on the road. But unfortunately, it also makes the highways less safe for the truck drivers themselves, who have extremely high levels of illness, death, and injury involving trucks, and are now basically being worked at a rate which is about double what the average American worker works per year.
I think that I know that having read about this, the people who are speaking for the federal government and for the administration would say that there has not been. In this time that we're talking about here in the last few years, there hasn't been any kind of a dramatic increase in the number of fatalities involving the thing really we're concentrating on is fatalities involving trucks and big trucks and passenger vehicles. Although obviously you wouldn't, an accident just involving trucks, if the driver's killed, is not a good thing either. But we're really concentrating on interactions between trucks and cars. I think they would say that if you take a look at the last 10, 15 years, there has not been a particularly significant or dramatic increase in highway deaths involving trucks.
Well, I would dispute that on several grounds, Mr. Inge. First of all, if you go back in the records of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which is the custodian of what we call the Fatality Analysis Reporting System, otherwise known in Washington, which cannot function without acronyms, as FARS. And in Washington, if you go back and look in those data banks all the way back to the middle 70s, you will find that the number of annual dead that are involved in truck crashes in the United States, both single-vehicle truck crashes and multi-vehicle collisions, almost always involving one or more small passenger vehicles, has not significantly changed. It has hovered around 4,900 to 5,200 for about more than a decade. And one of the unfortunate tragedies of heavy truck safety is the fact that heavy trucks are dramatically disproportionately represented in fatal crashes. For example, we have about 3 to 4% of all the heavy vehicles in the United States as representatives of the vehicle fleet, about 3 or 4%. But they represent about 9% of all fatal crashes, and 12 to 13% of all the annual individual fatalities can be chalked up to a collision involving a large truck. So unfortunately, their contribution to our annual tragic highway toll is greatly disproportionate to their numbers. I would dispute that claim. I would also like to point out that you have to recall that one of the anomalies of accident statistics is that you can have a rate continue to decline, and indeed the truck crash rate has slightly declined over the last 2 or 3 years, but it has done that in tandem with a decline of the passenger vehicle rate over the last 2 or 3 years as well. And in fact, the historical trend is almost always a downward trend, which we welcome in the rate. However, last year we had a surge in highway deaths involving all vehicles on the roads, even though the rate of those deaths slightly declined. And once again, even though we had a slight decrease in the rate of deaths involving heavy trucks, we nevertheless have not done anything to alter the actual number of dead. To me, trying to rely on a rate is a dodge. It's a shield against the fact that the actual number of people who are dead brothers, sisters, fathers, mothers, cousins, and close colleagues remains about the same year after year involving heavy trucks. And it is that raw number of actual dead that we need to decrease, not just play games with rates.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that you and other people would argue that we shouldn't be content with a rate that stays the same. We shouldn't say, well, that's good because it doesn't go up, when I think that you would argue is that there are things that could be done that could actually bring the rate, the death rate and accident rate down.
We would like the rate to decrease, and we would like the actual numbers to decrease commensurate with that improvement in the rate.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you look at the factors in accidents involving large trucks and passenger vehicles, would it be the case that driver fatigue would be the number one?
When the issue is heavy truck safety, there is absolutely no question that fatigue is one of the leading issues involved in driver error and the subsequent fatal or serious injury crashes. In fact, what we don't want to also get away from is that there is a significant problem of fatigue among all drivers of all vehicles, but at its worst, it is definitely virtually an epidemic among heavy truck drivers. The unfortunate fact is that we don't have any breathalyzer tests for fatigue. If a driver has a crash and there are fatalities or serious injuries involved, one of the anomalies of heavy truck safety is that the truck driver himself almost always survives. But a crash like that is an alerting event, and trying to indicate to a reporting officer what the telltale signs are of fatigue is almost an impossibility. And since drivers keep 2 and even 3 handwritten logbooks, very often they have concealed their actual hours of service so that they will not go above legal ceilings. And so you cannot even tell from their logbooks whether they have or have not violated both state and federal ceilings on hours of service. And even then, even if they have not, they are driving an excessive number of hours and working excessive hours during a work week, so that basically they're chronically sleep-deprived and fatigued, and their chances for an error are correspondingly maximized.
Yeah. Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Dr. Gerald Donaldson. He's the Senior Research Director of an organization called Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety. It's a highway and motor vehicle safety public interest lobbying organization that is interested generally in the subject of highway safety and how safe operation of motor vehicles, whether we're talking about passenger cars or we're talking about big trucks, making them more safe, reducing the number of accidents. And it is their concern, and other people who work in this kind of consumer advocacy organization, it is their concern that there has been a relaxation in the rules regulating big trucks, and that means they are less safe. And if the numbers of accidents have not been increasing, at least they would say that there are things that we could do to cut down on the numbers of accidents, and we're simply not doing them. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just real quickly, I have now suddenly several callers. Let me just ask basically now, there is a federal government, branch of the federal government. This is the Federal Motor Carrier Administration that does set federal rules, federal regulations for the number of hours that a driver can spend behind the wheel, how much time they can drive, how much time they have to have off. What are those rules now, and how is it they have been changed over the past couple of years?
Well, the rules to begin with, Mr. Inge, up until 2003 were bad enough as they were. Under those rules, a driver could drive 60 hours over 7 consecutive days or 70 hours over 8 consecutive days. They then had to take the amount of time off that would exhaust those actual 7 or 8 calendar days before they could get behind the wheel and drive again. They could cycle their time while they were driving to drive a maximum of 10 hours and take a minimum of 8 hours off duty. Long-haul drivers very often would approximate that kind of schedule, which we call in the field an acircadian schedule. That is, their rotation is less than 24 hours. So very often you would have a driver beginning to drive and beginning to attempt to rest after the end of his driving during that day at a very different time than he was the day before and a very different time the next day from the preceding day. Those rules were changed in 2003, and they were made far worse. What those rule changes did in 2003 was to up the number of consecutive hours that you could drive from 10 to 11. It increased the number of off-duty hours from 8 to 10. But what it did was to create, instead of a fixed, but a floating work week, so that if a driver ended up burning up his hours as quickly as possible, the 60 or 70 hours, all he had to do then was to take a minimum 34 hours off duty, and then in the days it used to be downtime, off duty time, that he could not drive, he now can get behind the wheel of the vehicle and he can drive over the next 2 or 3 days at a time when he was not previously allowed to drive. So what's the net result? The net result is that 60 hours of driving over 7 actual calendar days was increased to a maximum of 77 hours, and that 70 hours of driving was increased to 88 hours. And when you added the number of hours that driver could work in addition to driving, many drivers can get close to working 100 hours over an 8-day tour of duty.
Well, we have some callers, and as I expected, I think we're maybe going to hear from some truck drivers.
I hope so.
Let's go to line number 3, a cell phone, and this is, I believe, someone who is a driver calling in. Hi there, line 3, go ahead.
Good morning. This is Tim. I'm rolling on I-70 in Illinois right now.
How you doing, Tim? I'm Jerry Donaldson.
I suppose I'll live. How are you?
Well, we want you to keep living, Tim,
yeah.
Believe me.
Well, yeah, we want to know, what do you think about what the guest had to say? I mean, do you think that there's a problem with drivers driving longer than they should?
In many cases, yes. Now, forgive me, I've only heard about the last 20 minutes of your program here on this AM station, 580. I just got one main point. Yes, I agree that the rules were made worse. We don't agree on all points. I like the 34-hour break. However, the worst place where it was made worse was in the old days. You could split up your break however you wanted. At first, it was 8 hours required, like you said. Then, of course, now it's 10 hours required. Now, it used to be, in the old days, split breaks. You could take a 3-hour break and then a 5, you know, basically stop when you were tired.
Right.
Roll when you felt good.
Now, it's
now on the split break, they require you have at least 1 8-hour stretch physically in the sleeper, and then you still owe them 2. So it's 8 and 10, but they tell you how you can take it. And a lot of times, this puts you behind schedule, it screws you up, and you wind up driving more tired than you would have before, even with the shorter break that you could split any way you wanted.
Tim, I think that's a good point, and I think that for some drivers, it's definitely harder for them. But basically what the research showed us and the agency was that many drivers who are out there splitting their hours as 5 and 3 or 4 and 4, something like that, basically they didn't get adequate sleep. They were chronically sleep deprived. So the agency, on the basis of good research, said that you had to have at least a minimum 8-hour block of sleep so you could get almost all of the anchor sleep that you need. And then you had that 2-hour break, which, as you know, they no longer require you to spend in the sleeper berth. You can do as you please for off-duty time. And I can see how that can mess up your schedule, but some drivers out there are probably better off now with that single 8-hour block of sleep than they were before.
Yes, sir. Some. However, I can tell you from...
It's one size fits all, Tim. We know that.
Go ahead.
Yep.
No, yeah, go ahead, Tim.
From my seat of the pants in the seat, the new way is a lot harder on me. And I think you find the majority of drivers, actual real drivers, not lab rats, agree with me.
Mm-hmm. How do you like having the 10 hours all told as opposed to the 8 hours under the old rule?
Well, now with the weird split... you have to have 10 straight. I take 10 straight a lot more than I split now. I used to split to 8 all the time.
Uh-huh.
Now by the time you get down to the end of your 14, but by the way, it used to be a 15-hour total. Now it's 14 and rather than,
right.
You know.
15 hours plus.
Now by the time you get to the end of it, you're wore out. You're whooped. Mm-hmm. You need 10 hours.
Are you finding that the 34-hour off-duty period to restart your clock, Tim, is getting you to drive more hours or work more hours over a 7 or 8 day sequence than you did before?
Well, my dispatcher does not like the 34-hour reset, and if you got 2 hours left, she wants you to use them. So I have used that maybe twice in the last year.
Well, however, you're very fortunate. You're very fortunate.
You know,
there are a lot of drivers out there who call me, Tim, and tell me that they are driving a lot more hours and working a lot longer hours over 7 or 8 consecutive days than they did under the old rules. And they tell me that they're a lot more worn out than they were before. So I think you're in a good position not having a dispatcher that's trying to get even more hours out of you with a 34-hour restart.
Well, I'm with a good company. They audit our logs real hard.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, with the company I'm with, I'm not going to mention the name, but everybody knows the big refrigerated carrier. If you screw up on your logs, you will be gone, and you will be gone quickly.
That's very often true of very large companies, and as you descend in the size of the carrier, usually things get worse for safety.
Yes.
Well, thanks for calling. We certainly appreciate you calling and telling us about some of your experiences.
Thank you all.
Let's go on to somebody here in Champaign. We'll come back here local. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I have a couple concerns. I drive cars rather than trucks other than pickups, and my concern is the speed with which trucks are passing now. The passing, I say, when I'm driving the speed limit, I'm being passed by trucks, and yet in Illinois, the speed limit for the 18-wheelers is 10 miles an hour less than my car.
Right. Right.
That concerns me a great deal, and the second thing is an issue I think would be easy to resolve, and that is in the rain when I'm driving and being passed by one of these 18-wheelers. I'm getting a tremendous spray from the side, which completely obliterates my ability to see, especially at night. And yet when some of the trucks pass, that doesn't happen, and it seems that they have a mechanism on the side of their back tires, which hangs down like a hanging curtain and dissipates that spray.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So those are my concerns regarding trucks.
Well, if I can respond directly to that, Mr. Inge, I think those are two excellent points. The first one about the speeds, it would be facetious for me to say that you were having a unique experience. We all have had the experience of being at speed or even above the speed limit and having trucks passing us by like we're standing still. There isn't any question that one of the reasons why that has happened, two of the reasons why that has happened, is first, drivers being on very closely controlled dispatch and delivery times for consignees. It's what's called just-in-time delivery, JIT, JIT. And that, along with being able to constantly roll according to dispatch and to get the economic efficiency that a large carrier, for example, demands, a lot of the drivers out there are basically highballing it as much as possible, violating speed limits, also falsifying their logbooks to make that delivery. That's one of the reasons why you're being passed like that, almost as if you were standing still. The second issue that you referred to about the splash and spray, It has been around, I'm sorry to say, for 15 or 20 years, and the agency of jurisdiction over that is actually the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which sets the specifications and the design criteria for new vehicles as they roll off the assembly line. Splash and spray is definitely a serious problem. It has definitely become a more serious problem because we have the squaring of the demographic pyramid in America. And what that means is that we've got more old guys like me out there. I'm going to be 65 in July. And as you all age, your ability to negotiate a highway at speed is reduced. You can't see as well. Your static acuity can be reduced. Your lateral vision is narrowed. And to be blinded by an enormous splash and spray being thrown up on your windshield when you try to pass a truck, which very often happens in a very sudden and alarming manner, is definitely a serious problem. The bad news is that the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has brought up this issue twice and dropped it twice. We zealously advocated a mandate to be sent down from the agency to all newly manufactured vehicles that they have to be equipped with appropriate splash and spray suppression devices. It would be left up to the design ingenuity of each manufacturer to come up what it would be, but there would be a performance standard that they would have to meet. After that would be in place, then the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration would then also be asked to require a retrofit of existing trucks on the road. I'm sorry to report that here in 2007, we're no closer to getting a splash and spray suppression standard, both from the original agency of jurisdiction and from the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, than we were 15 years ago. It looks pretty hopeless. Definitely some carriers out there are doing a better job than others with suppression devices. Some are doing a poor job, and as you know, some are doing no job at all. And for all practical purposes, you're completely blinded when you attempt to pass a truck at speed.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call, and keep up the work.
We will certainly try again. I'm glad you brought up the topic again.
Well, let me just real quick again touch on the issue of speeding trucks.
Yes.
It's my understanding that last fall, in fact, the American Trucking Association and also a number of the very large companies supported putting speed controls,
yeah,
that is a device on the truck that would limit speed governors, that would limit to how fast the truck can go.
Yes, and the proposal is for a 68-mile-an-hour maximum. Two or three things about that. Without getting into the details, first of all, since the American Trucking Association is basically cited here in the greater Washington area, you can be sure that there are political considerations involved in this and not just the safety of the traveling public, and I'll leave it at that. Number two, governors have been present on a number of large carriers out there for quite a number of years, and they have found that when they keep their trucks within a narrower speed limit on the highway, they don't create those high-speed differentials with slower-moving passenger vehicle traffic. Their truckers have less accidents, less severe accidents, less fatal accidents, because, of course, we know that every time you increase speed by, say, 5 mile-an-hour increments, the chances of an error resulting in a crash are correspondingly magnified, and the severity of the crash is magnified. The bad thing about governors is the fact that in certain types of terrain, a heavily laden truck with a driver under the gun to make a delivery at a specific time is still going to speed, because the driver is going to go up a grade, say a 3 or 4% grade at 35 or 40 or 45 miles an hour. But when he gets to the top of that grade, he's going to put the pedal to the metal, and he's going to highball the downgrade, and that speedometer needle is going to go way up above 68, even with a governor on there. So a governor will give us some relief and will narrow the speed limit under some circumstances, particularly on level terrain. But unfortunately, you're still going to see that speed exceeded on a downgrade.
Well, it sounds like what you're saying is that you would support that, although it wouldn't solve the problem of speeding.
It won't involve the topic. And actually, there is a large amount of a food fight going on here between the large organized carriers under the umbrella of the American Trucking Associations and smaller carriers and independent owner-operators who belong to a competing organization. So, as I say, there are political and economic competitive reasons that are partly motivating the 68-mile-an-hour. But on safety grounds alone, it's a better idea to have governors than not. So I would agree that they would be desirable.
And this would be, would that, if the government decided to implement such a rule, would this be something that would be promulgated by the Federal Motor Carrier Administration, or is there some other part of the government?
It would be the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, because they are the agency of jurisdiction on interstate commerce. So any truck above 10,000 pounds gross vehicle weight that is registered and has been given operating authority by the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration is under their stewardship, and they would have the right to impose a requirement that all operating motor carriers on the road have governors. It could start with NHTSA, as you ask, and it could be mandated as a required piece of safety equipment on any newly manufactured vehicle. But if we wanted to get thing going as fast as possible, it would be an immediate requirement to all existing carriers on the road that they would have to equip their vehicles with governors.
We are at our midpoint here. We have some other callers. We'll get right to them.
Fine.
But I would like to introduce again our guest, Dr. Gerald Donaldson. He is the Senior Research Director of an organization called Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety. It's a highway and motor vehicle safety public interest lobbying organization. Also, before that, he was the co-chair of Citizens for Reliable and Safe Highways, a nationwide truck safety public interest organization. And before that, he worked as a researcher and advocate for the Center for Auto Safety, a nonprofit public interest consumer organization. We're talking here about highway safety, particularly when it comes to trucks, big long-distance trucks. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk next with someone in Mattoon, line two. Hello.
I've got a couple of quick little comments. One would be that part of the problem is the two different speed limits for Illinois interstate. That creates two different things going on. And the other quick comment would be some of the accidents that I've observed have been small vehicles, small cars and trucks, not understanding the trucks and the room it takes, them traveling way faster than the speed limit. Talk about trucks. I think we got enough laws on the books. We just need to police the laws we already have. Cars, passing semis on the right side, not getting enough room, them running 70, 80 miles an hour. It's just, there's a lot of stuff going on. It's not always the trucks, right?
I agree with a lot of what you're saying. There isn't any question that a lot of passenger vehicle drivers out there do not really understand, they don't comprehend that a truck takes a much longer distance to stop, that many of the quick maneuvers that a passenger vehicle, a four-wheeler, can make, a big combination rig cannot make, because basically puts the driver and the rig at risk of having a serious crash. Those passenger vehicle drivers definitely need to be better educated in how to behave around big trucks. Another problem is that they also don't realize that you guys have a lot of big blind zones out there, and that there are large areas of the truck on either side and to the immediate rear where you can't even see a small vehicle, so you can't even do anything to actually safely evade having a conflict with them. So those are things that definitely need to be taken under consideration. And I agree with you that mutual education of both truck and passenger vehicle drivers on how to share the road better would gain us a lot. As far as the speed differential goes that you were pointing out, it's very difficult to know how to deal with public policy in that regard. And you correctly point out that we've got a lot of the laws in the books that we have now. Why don't we just enforce them? Well, probably in states where we have speed differentials where trucks are required to operate at 10 miles an hour below passenger vehicles, which is usually the law that's on the books, and it's the law on the books in a number of states right now. For all practical purposes, we all know that that law isn't really being enforced, and that truckers are actually going at the speed that I think is required for them to be able to get a load and to go on their backhaul and pick up another load. The problem also is the fact that we have conflicting research out there about differential speed limits. I could cite to you a dozen studies on one hand that say that it's a good idea for safety, and I can cite a dozen studies on the other hand saying it's not a good idea. If trucks did operate at 10 miles below the speed limit, I think that if they have serious issues involving performance and conflicts with other vehicles, the chances of their having a severe crash would be reduced. But the reality is that they don't obey the differential speed limit that's posted lower for them, and there isn't really good enforcement out there. We all know in every state in the United States how poor the enforcement is, particularly on our interstate highways for speed violations.
Yeah, and one other comment as far as trucks.
Yes, sir.
I see drivers, I see drivers here that, they can't speak English. They can't, they couldn't back a truck up. I don't know how they get by, but they just can't back up their own truck. You know, they can't read the rules. If you look at the example yesterday at the truck in Miami port, they were having a problem with the language. And
that's another great point that you're making, and I'll make two or three real quick comments about that. First of all, as you know, we have the southern border right now basically closed to long-haul commerce from Mexico. When the applicants from Mexico domiciled motor carriers would like to enter the United States, unfortunately, there is a whole system of self-certifications on the form, which for all practical purposes, no intelligent person is going to ever tick no. They're always going to tick yes, including their familiarity with American laws involving traffic violations, with all the federal requirements involving motor carrier operations and the haul of hazmat and the haul of passengers and things like that. So basically, we're going to consider allowing Mexican trucks in the United States on the basis of self-certification, which we know in many instances aren't going to be made in good faith. Your problem about language is a serious one, and it's been around now for about 15 years. At one time, the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration's predecessor agency, which at that time was the Federal Highway Administration, put out a rulemaking proposing that all drivers in commerce in the United States had to have the ability to be able to read and comprehend the English language, which is crucial, as you know, to understanding traffic laws and ordinances and being able to understand the directions and the warnings and traffic control out on our highways. Basically, there were challenges to that by civil rights groups as being unacceptable. The rulemaking has basically gone into a back burner. It's brought up every year in the calendar of regulatory actions for the agency. No action is ever taken on it. It's still simmering back there in the back of the stove, and it's very hard to tell whether it'll ever be taken up again.
All right. Well, again, I thank the caller and say we got to go on to the next, and that is someone in Martinsville, line 4. Hello.
Yes, I have a couple of things that I. One of them is the rutting of the trucks put in the highways that on the asphalt that seem to occur very quickly after it's been resurfaced.
Right.
Oh, that's a very dangerous hydroplaning situation for cars.
Yep.
And maybe even trucks. But I talked to an engineer for the Illinois Department of Highways, and they said it's because of the asphalt industry has got such a hold on contracting or whatever that they won't go continuously back to cement. But I'd like you to address that issue. Another thing is that in England, they have three lanes, and two lanes are for the trucks, and one lane, the fast lane, are for the cars only. I think in the United States, with the traffic load that we're having today on the interstates, this would probably be a better alternative. It probably would help truckers and what do you think about that? Thank you.
Well, those are two excellent points, and unfortunately, Mr. Inge is probably already aware that I could talk until the cows come home on both of those, and the first of them having to do with asphalt. First, except for a relatively minor contribution in from environmental effects, the freeze-thaw cycle, particularly in the northern tier of states in the United States, virtually all pavement destruction in the United States is caused by heavy axle loads, and that means large trucks. Rutting is a serious problem. Very often what has happened is that we've had a lower-class road, such as a minor arterial, which used to have a very low level of truck traffic, say 1, 2, or 3% of the traffic volume. But over the years, it has become an access point to get to a terminal for what we call less-than-truckload carriage. So all of a sudden, that minor arterial, instead of having 2% trucks, it has 10 or 12 or 14% trucks. So it has many more axle loads. And unfortunately, we spent our money back in the 70s and the 80s in the United States resurfacing existing highways with new wear layers, that is the top surface, without going back and redoing those highways and doing their base and sub-bases to much more demanding criteria so they could withstand those heavy axle loads. So we beat them to pieces. And unfortunately, right now, what's been in the offing for many years is a trucking industry that, if you think trucks are big now, you wait and see how big they want them to get. We've had moves afoot that we have fought back now for almost 20 years to have trucks go to over 100,000 pounds and to carry 6 and 7 and 8 axles instead of 5 axles. And that's a story in itself. The other issue about confining trucks to lanes, as is everything else in life, there are no magic bullets, and there are good things and bad things about that. The bad things about that is that when you have a highway and you premised it as being, say, 3 lanes, and we have 1 lane which is available for high-speed movement and for passenger cars only, but the other two are confined to heavy trucks. The bad thing is that when you have thoroughfares which already have high truck volume, let's say that the volume that was spread out over those 3 lanes was 14 to 16%, and in many highways like I-81 going down the Shenandoah Ridge in Virginia, 1 out of every 2 heavy vehicles on the road, or 2 vehicles on the road, is a heavy vehicle. Virtually 50% of the traffic is heavy trucks. If you now confine them to the 2 right lanes, you've now basically saturated those right lanes with 20, 22, 24% heavy truck traffic. Very often trucks will slipstream each other for fuel efficiency. They will operate very close to the rear of the preceding truck in the queue. Passenger vehicles cannot find a way to get between those trucks to be able to get to a departure ramp on an interstate, for example. The vehicles are 13.5 feet high, and in many instances, a passenger car driver's line of sight is completely blocked by tractor-trailers, so they cannot see any of the warning or destination signs which provide information for them about where they want to leave the highway or where they should be taking another routing. So those are some of the bad things that happen. The good things are that you decrease the conflicts for the cars once they're in the high-speed left-hand lane, for example, but once they need to access another lane, you've actually increased the conflicts. So there are people on both sides of the argument as to whether it's a good idea to have truck-only restricted lanes.
Okay, well,
that's the short lecture.
I appreciate the question and the answer.
Thank you.
Let's go talk with someone else. This is someone here in Champaign County where we are, line number 3.
Hi.
Hello. Yes.
I have a long list, but I guess I won't get to all of them. I was just cut off by a trucker who wasn't signaling. I'm used to truckers signaling when they change lanes. I'm going to take a video camera with me and carry it and have it at hand and document. And when they say call in the bad drivers, I don't want to blame the drivers. I think I wanted to preface the remark by saying I think there's just too much freight on the roads, and it's not your bailiwick, but it's probably the rail advocacy groups that need to say, you know, why are we doing this? I don't want to take away jobs from drivers either. But details, there are some technical fixes. The new LEDs, there's quite a variance between how brightly lit. And on the foggy, misty day that I was cut off, I mean, I could barely see ahead to see whether it was a car or a truck in the distance, and I didn't. There was another occasion, too. And there are these brightly lit LEDs that are happening. And when you talk about rearview mirrors, you know, Priuses have, and some trucks have backup videos, like, you know,
right.
It's going to be money there too, probably, but there should be better viewing systems, it seems, on trucks.
Well, these are the best groups of questions and comments I think I've gotten in a long, long time from call-ins, and you have 2 excellent points there. Let me take the latter one first. Yes, I agree with you about, let's confine the discussion from the beginning to just daytime visibility. One of the problems with heavy trucks out there is that quite some years ago, we had a move by the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration and its former guise of the Federal Highway Administration to require retrofits of existing trucks out there with both rear and side conspicuity enhancement. Believe it or not, that's the actual term of art, conspicuity enhancement, to make them more conspicuous to a driver, particularly at night. But when that was done, and what came out of the end of the pipe was sort of a half-hearted rule, which was not close to being optimal, One of the things that we did when we commented to the regulation docket was we said that the agency was long overdue to reform the basic lighting platform on heavy trucks, which for all practical purposes has not changed since about 1948. So you're talking about visibility problems involving large trucks in terms of the number and the placement and the brightness of the lights, which for all practical purposes has not changed in almost 60 years. That's way overdue. So your point is absolutely well taken about having that. As far as visibility improvements for the commercial driver, yes, we cannot rely just on static mirror systems. We have seen for too many years, and we know too critically, that there are enormous blind spots alongside both sides of a heavy truck and to the immediate rear of it. We need to have systems that involve probably not only video or camera systems, but also radar detection or laser beams or radar, some system to provide an addition, a boost to the driver to be able to have complete circumferential ability to detect any hazard there near their truck, which is way outside the scope of their mirrors. And I agree with you, and I think the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is long overdue for addressing this and dramatically improving the visibility requirements for truck drivers who will benefit not only in saving their own lives, but saving the lives of others sharing the road with them.
I know, again, it's beyond your purvey probably, but I really think that the general topic begs the idea that there's just too much rail transport on the road, and I don't want to take anybody's job away, but it seems like, from the point of view of fuel efficiency and efficiency.
Well, I can say in regard to that comment that we've had some studies. One of them was done in Minnesota a couple of years ago. Another one was done in Maine recently, which pointed out that, in fact, we were diverting freight to trucks in a way that actually was more inefficient than being able to carry it on parallel rail lines, which, of course, in terms of the amount of tonnage moved, is many times safer than moving it by heavy truck. And both the Minnesota legislature and the special group that was commissioned by the governor to study this issue in Maine found that, in fact, we were destroying their roads in both states at an increasing rate. We were increasing air pollution. We were causing more pavement damage, which in Maine, they have no money whatever to fix the roads, and they deferred their entire 2007 capital improvement plan almost all entirely because of heavy truck traffic. So, yes, we need to have a balanced transportation system in which there's a rational assessment of what diversion of freight is efficiently carried and safely carried by rail and which is carried by truck. But as you probably are aware, the competition between trucking and rail is very keen, and fundamentally it's a political and economic spoil system. And to date, the rail has been basically in retreat for a quarter century, and the trucking industry has been in the ascendancy.
We just have about 5 minutes left,
certainly.
And I have a number of other callers, and again, I hope the caller will forgive me if I go on. I want to try to get at least one or two more.
And I'll try to keep those answers shorter.
All right, let's go to Kankakee, line one, next. Hello.
Should not all new major roadway construction in the United States provide unsubsidized, separate, and distinct parallel roadways for cargo vehicles and passenger vehicles? Would the guest please discuss such a resolution?
You should or you shouldn't have separate roadways for trucks. I didn't catch that.
No, I think he was arguing for that, saying ideally in the perfect world, maybe we'd have two road systems, one for trucks and one for passenger vehicles.
Well, I like your footnote of a perfect world. Because, in fact, given right now the fact that we are dramatically undercapitalizing America's surface road infrastructure, which is about 3.93 million miles of roads and streets. We don't have the money even to maintain the roads, much less in most instances, even in high-volume facilities, to rehabilitate and reconstruct them to higher and safer design standards and better and longer-life pavement. The chances of being able, along with the environmental hurdles and the ability to meet the demands of the Clean Air Act attainment goals, to create parallel roadways, which will almost certainly cause an attraction of commercial volume to those roads so that you even magnify the number of vehicles per day that are using the corridor, both for trucks and for cars, I don't think the chances are very good. It's not to say that in a few instances that might be warranted, but as a general rule, I don't think it will come to pass, and I don't think America has the money to be able to capitalize that right now.
All right. Next caller is line two, and this is Champagne. Hello.
Yes, I read an article, I believe in USA Today, that says there's a great safety problem with a large number of fraudulent driver's license operators of large over-the-road trucks. Is that a problem that you are familiar with?
Well, unfortunately, it was a big problem in Illinois because there was a serious problem of commercial driver license fraud that was committed in the state several years ago that was snuffed out. In general, commercial driver's licenses are actually, for interstate commerce, almost never fraudulent nowadays, because back in the middle 1980s, Congress passed a law requiring that a large truck driver, a truck driver of a rig over 26,000 pounds, was allowed to have, from then forward, only one license. A lot of drivers carried as many cards as it would be, driver's licenses as cards in a poker deck. And when they got the right situation with the right enforcement officer, they would peel off a license from one state so they could dock their violations in that state, and they would keep the other state safe so they could peel out a license for another state and get the violation spread out over several states' licenses. That was put to rest about 20 years ago, and nowadays is almost nothing like that. One of the problems, though, is the fact that truck drivers have to meet more demanding physical and medical qualifications than passenger car drivers, and there are many drivers out there right now whose health is seriously impaired, and they know that if they go in and get a new medical certificate, they will fail the physical test, and so they take their chances and they drive with an expired medical certificate, or they try to game the healthcare system, and they find a health provider where they'll be able to get a medical certificate from a healthcare provider who doesn't know that the requirements are more stringent. So we do have a problem in that regard, but not very much with fraudulent driver licenses themselves.
All right, thank you.
All right, thanks. Let's go to Germantown Hills, Illinois, line four. Hello.
Good morning. I've got a brief comment and a quick question. The brief comment is that living here in central Illinois and driving a lot on state and county roads, the scariest trucks I see out there are typically grain haulers. And I assume that a lot of these are part-time drivers who don't really understand their rigs and what they could do very well. And looking in your rearview mirror and seeing the entire mirror occupied by the grill of a grain truck around your tail is a pretty scary sight. And I hope that some of our farmer friends who are listening to this good station talk to their haulers about that. The other is, when you see, you talked before about slipstreaming and trucks being so close to one another. Semis are the biggest tailgaters in the world. Do they really have to drive that way? Because it's frightening to see, to think about what happens when there's an accident and a whole series of trucks rammed together.
Right. Well, no, they don't have to drive that way, but they do it to slightly increase fuel efficiency. And when you have that whole queue already equaling or exceeding the speed limit, then there are the efficiencies of also getting your load there as quickly as possible. Do they have to drive that way? No, but as I indicated earlier in the program, the dispatchers are very often watching them very closely so that their just-in-time deliveries are made on the calendar that's been given to them at the start of a tour of duty. Your other comment, though, about the grain haulers, that is a serious problem. The reason that it's a serious problem is that farm interests for many years now have lobbied to relax the hours of service requirements for grain haulers. And during the active agricultural harvesting and planting season in the United States, guess what the hours of service limits are for any type of agricultural driver, including a part-time agricultural driver? And the answer is none. There are no limits. You can drive for as long as you want, and if a large agribusiness wanted to demand that you drive around the clock with no rest break at all, under the current regulations, they could do that. So agricultural drivers, many of whom are very often not that adept at driving big rigs, have the paradox of also not being controlled by any hours of service limits during the planting and harvesting season. So that is a serious safety problem. We fought the exemptions, but we lost.
Well, thanks for your comment.
All right, thank you. Let's go to Muhammad here, line three. Hello.
Hi. Very, very good topic this morning, and an excellent guest. As a person that spends much of my time on the road around this country, I think that most drivers today, all of us, ones that are in sedans, RVs, and mainly, you know, truckers, we drive too aggressively. And it just, it kind of just, it perpetuates that aggressiveness. And it's scary out there. I too agree with one of the previous callers. It's frightening to be on a regular highway, two lane, and you've got a truck behind you that's in your rearview mirror. I don't. What do you think we should do about that kind of stuff?
And you know what? I'm going to have to jump in here and say, well, I can't give you the chance to answer the question because I've got to end a little early today. I tell you what, though, Mr. Donaldson, maybe on another day you'll be with us again, and I think there are a lot of other things that we can talk about that have to do with highway safety, including that. Well, our guest is Gerald Donaldson. He is the Senior Research Director of Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety, a highway and motor vehicle safety public interest lobbying organization in Washington. And Dr. Donaldson, thank you very much.
I enjoyed it very much. Thank you, sir.